So welcome to the third and final lecture for this year's Thinking Out Loud, which is delivered by Professor Villazendi. And the title of the lectures, though, the lecture series is Economy. We're very much looking forward to seeing the book as well from Fordham University Press. On Monday, Peter showed us how images have this propensity to create a movement of exchange, and in a sense, an exchange that is reminiscent of the exchange that moves the economy. And then on Wednesday, Professor Villazendi showed us how the exchange image, as he calls it, this exchange economy of the image, is always asymmetrical. It can never be. The exchange of images can never create an absolute equality. There is always a debtor and a creditor. So let's see where Peter takes us after that. Peter.
Thank you so much, Dimitris, for summing up also where we are, where we arrived, and yes, let's say where we are getting now. So yes, my first lecture on Monday, as Dimitris reminded us, introduced the notion of iconomy, what I called iconomy, that is to say an economy of images, and the idea that, that's what we saw on Monday, the idea that money, or what money is the name of, or for, money is the other side, the verso of images, as Gilles Deleuze puts it in The Time Image. Or, in other words, that images are what they are because of what Robert Bresson, a director that we saw some films of on Monday. So images are what they are because of what Bresson calls their exchange value. So that there is no image, in a way, we were saying. There is no image, there are only images, and their speed, I would say, or various speeds from very slow to very quick, various speeds of exchange between the images, which means, for example, a very slow speed would be what we know under the name of painting, fresco, etc. And a very quick speed would be digital images, morphing. So there are only images and various speeds in their circulation, in their swapping exchanges. Then that was the idea of the first lecture. Then the second lecture, we tried to take a closer look into this notion of exchange between images. And what we noticed, what we ended up with, as Dimitris just recalled, is that there is no exchange, actually. If we take the notion or the concept of exchange seriously and rigorously, with all what it implies, all that it implies in terms of mutuality, reciprocity, simultaneousness, so this stigmatic, punctual instant where the one and the other are exactly mutually giving and taking, etc., there is no exchange because, quite simply, time always gets in the process, disturbs the perfect simultaneousness of exchange, so that we end up with having only debt or credit, but no exchange. So to put that in other words, we could say that exchange is a fiction, right? Exchange is only a fiction, and so this is not so it's not so unusual or original to say that. After all, it was exactly what Marx, in his famous Grundrisse, was saying. Exchange is a fiction, and a fiction, a necessary fiction, in order to produce or create debt. So What we tried to do was to transpose, to translate, in a way, this economic vocabulary that we already find in Marx or elsewhere, to translate it, to transpose it in the field, in the I'm almost tempted to say in the ontology of images, so on the plane where images exist. And that's why I tried to propose the concept of the concept of an exchange image, which would not even be necessarily the image of an exchange, the representation of exchange, but an image that itself would be sort of flipping over and showing the one and the other, the one point of view and the other point of view. So it would be an oscillating image that would be in the middle of this sight line, or so that would be the exchange image, which doesn't exist. We concluded the second lecture saying that rather than an exchange image, what we have, and actually that's what we will explore also today, what we have is debt images or credit images, meaning that every image is always already indebted toward another, waiting for another, in this circulation of images, images that take their meaning or sense or being or whatever from the very fact that there are other images and that they are exchanged with other images, but not in terms of exchange, in terms of debt. Okay, so that's more or less where we arrive. So, today's lecture has a title, and the title is innervation. That will be a very important concept or idea. Innervation, to innervate, right? Innervation, or the gaze of capital. How might I see with a borrowed gaze? And supposing that my vision might be able to result in this way from an exchange of views, take the expression literally, from an exchange of views, supposing that I might receive prosthetic or grafted eyes, what would they allow me to see once they had been endowed with feeling or perceiving nerve endings? We find the idea of a visibility that would thus be innervated, we find this idea among the notes and materials accumulated by Walter Benjamin with an eye to his arcades project. It appears in the dossier, in the convolute called Marx. I quote Benjamin, "On the doctrine of revolutions as innervations of the collective." Zur Lehre von den Revolutionen als Innervationen des Kollektivs. Benjamin writes, at the top of the passage, he copies from Marx's 1844 manuscripts. In other words, we read this at the beginning of the first lecture, the text where Marx speaks, you might recall, of social organs. Social organs. We are therefore right to trace the Benjaminian theme of innervation to those pages from Marx on the fabrication, Bildung, of the senses, the fabrication of the sensible. We do see the appearance of the notion of innervation used in neuropsychology since the 1830s. We do see it in different published texts by Benjamin, as well as in certain posthumous fragments. We find it, for example, in a kind of manifesto written in 1928 and destined to be a program for a proletarian children's theater. Noting that every gesture of a child is a creative innervation in exact correspondence with receptive innervation, Benjamin also describes the painter as, I quote, a man who sees more accurately with his hand when his eye fails him, who is able to transfer the receptive innervation of the eye's muscles into the creative innervation of the hand. End of quote. One finds a comparable intuition, yet again, in notes probably dating from 1928-1930, on a theory of gambling, among the posthumous fragments by Benjamin. I quote him, "For the gambler, too," and here it is a roulette wheel that is at stake, that is being described, "for the gambler, too," Benjamin writes, "what is decisive is the level of motor innervation, and the more emancipated it is from optical perception, the more decisive it is." End of quote. And finally, in a 1931 homage to Paul Valéry, to the French writer, we find a citation from the poet on the importance of electricity, described by Valéry as the general innervation of the world. End of quote. So, various occurrences in Benjamin's work of this notion, innervation. However, the idea that a social organization or apparatus might be innervated, in other words, that a shared prosthesis could start living and consisting organically in order to feel, this idea certainly comes into the Benjaminian text from Marx, as is proved not only by the aforementioned Marx convolute from the Arcades project, but also by the 1929 article on Surrealism. There, Benjamin envisages and dreams that one day, I quote, "body and image space, Leib und Bildraum, body and image space, interpenetrate so deeply that all revolutionary tension becomes an innervation of the collective body." End of quote. Here, then, it is assuredly a matter of equipping, appareiller, we would say in French, equipping the aesthesis, the sensible. Or better yet, it is a matter of what we might describe, in a sense I tried to indicate in a book entitled Membre Fantôme, Phantom Limbs, what we might describe as a general organology of the sensible. There is nonetheless undeniably a certain irony in having to observe that this revolutionary innervation that Benjamin speaks of in the wake of Marx was achieved in, for, and by capitalist economy. For, as we will see, it is in the supermarket of the visible that we witness the shaping of a certain organology of the gaze as exchange, or rather as the fiction of exchange denounced by Marx. But before turning to this, we must, on the one hand, go through the different versions of the essay in which the Benjaminian concept of innervation unfurls with all its meanings. I'm speaking of the work of art in the age of its technological reproducibility, that you might know, and very well-known essay. And on the other hand, we must sketch out the history of the mechanization of visibility that allowed for a true, as we will see, for a true privatization of the gaze, privatization of sight. This history will bring us to our current day, to this historical moment today, when from film to the internet, eye tracking or oculometrics is becoming the field of a planetary monetization of each minimal twitch of our eyes. What will remain an open question, though, is whether this possibility currently being realized is not an inherent part of the economy of sensation as such. Now, the singular Benjaminian concept of innervation plays an important role in the first three versions of the essay on the work of art in the age of its mechanical reproduction. Versions that date from 1935, this is the first German version, 1936, the second German version, and the same year, the French translation, which benefited from Benjamin's active collaboration. But this concept of innervation, it disappears, however, from the fourth and last version, which probably dates from 1938. In the 1935 text, it appears only once after Benjamin has described current society as facing an emancipated technology that is opposed to it, or that escapes it, a technique over which man is no longer master, and which nonetheless becomes for him like a second nature. I quote Benjamin, "The function of film is to train human beings in the apperceptions and reactions needed to deal with a vast apparatus whose role in their lives is expanding almost daily. Making this monstrous technical apparatus of our time into an object of human innervation, such is the historical task in the service of which film finds its true sense." End of quote. Film is therefore a way of training oneself, üben, he says in German. On the one hand, training in new apperceptions, that is, in the unprecedented modes of conscious crystallizing that may affect our countless confused perceptions or unconscious little perceptions, as Leibniz would say, Leibniz to whose monadology we owe the term of apperception. Apperception being the becoming conscious of perception, or a perception that has become conscious. But on the other hand, it is a training to, as Benjamin says, to new reactions. Reactions that, as ways of reacting, do not necessarily seem to require their showing on the surface of consciousness. So much so that one mustn't rush to attributing the innervation Benjamin is speaking of with the function of a becoming conscious. It is much rather this innervation, it is situated on the threshold, in other words, on one side and the other, of the limit where sensation becomes explicit, clear, awakened, or reflected. In this sense, if the filmic apparatus is a second nature, as Benjamin says, it is one that it is precisely a matter of naturalizing and incorporating, like an artificial graft that would become organic, that would end up becoming a part of a supposedly proper body, like innervated flesh. In the 1936 French translation of the essay by Pierre Klossowski that Benjamin supervised, the same passage is taken up and developed in a long note whose beginning must be cited in context. So I quote, "The function of film is to train human beings in the apperceptions and reactions needed to deal with a vast apparatus whose role in their lives is expanding almost daily." We have read that already. "Dealing with this also teaches them that technology will release them from their momentary enslavement to the powers of the apparatus only when humanity's economic structure has adapted itself to the new productive forces which the second technology has set into motion." And here comes the footnote. "The aim of revolutions is to accelerate this adaptation. Revolutions are innervations of the collective, or, more precisely, efforts at innervation on the part of the collective, which for the first time in history has its organs in the new technology. End of quote. The Marxian and revolutionary provenance of this theme of organic innervation, as it explicitly appeared in the convolute from the Arcades project that I previously quoted, this Marxian origin is only implicit here, even as it is clearly perceivable, I think. But there are also other, more or less audible echoes of Marx in the text, to which we need to lend an ear in order to attempt to understand what we thus incorporate by innervating the filmic apparatus. With what Benjamin names the second technology, I'm coming to this, it is not simply a matter of seeing better or more or otherwise. What is at stake in its incorporation is not only the increased acuity of the gaze, its almost surgical or endoscopic capacity for penetrating the visible, mentioned by Benjamin a bit further on, what the organological graft of the filmic apparatus transplants and imports into us is a gaze that, by sharpening, also itself becomes a market of exchanges or of fictions of exchanges, of the swapping fictions of capital. What is this second technology whose aftermath and consequences Benjamin is exploring? His argument is well known, but it's worth recalling. This technology, characterized as mechanical, is qualified as secondary in contrast with a primary one that, like in prehistoric art, is, I quote, in fusion with ritual. But most importantly, the two technologies diverge in terms of the place they reserve for reproducibility. As Benjamin writes in the last version of the essay, quote, the unique value, the einzigartige Wert, the unique value of the authentic work of art has its basis in ritual, the source of its original use value, Gebrauchswert. End of quote. Now, to this value that Benjamin also qualifies as cult value, Kultwert, to this use value in worship or in ritual is opposed what Benjamin calls, famously, the exhibition value, Ausstellungswert, which it is then difficult not to interpret as an exchange value in the Marxian sense. Marx's famous conceptual couple, Gebrauchswert and Tauschwert, use value and exchange value, is translated here into the specific terms of an economy of images, of an iconomy. Now, in the long perspective that leads him from cave art to film, Benjamin wants to grasp the way iconomy on the one hand, the value of images, and aesthetics on the other hand, aesthetics in the Greek sense of a theory of perception, iconomy and aesthetics then act upon one another or translate into one another. Even more precisely, what Benjamin is after are the iconomic determinations of the gaze. For on the one hand, the hypothetical or asymptotic limit to a pure use value for the image would be that the image is not seen. And on the other hand, the limit of its pure exchange value, of the image's pure exchange value, would be its dissolution into the infinite number of gazes to which the image is exposed. It is precisely toward this second limit of pure exchange value that the current iconomy tends, according to Benjamin. Today, he writes, I quote, today, through the absolute emphasis placed on its exhibition value, the work of art becomes a construct with quite new functions. Among these, the one we are conscious of, the artistic function may subsequently be seen as incidental. End of quote. The images circulating for and in front of our eyes would thus have almost no other consistency than that of their capacity to go from gaze to gaze. Yet to this current metamorphosis of iconicity also corresponds a mutation of the gaze that bears upon it. The gaze becomes dispersed or disseminated, says Benjamin, zerstreut, he writes in German. In other words, in the French version of 1936, distrait, distracted. And this word needs to be understood literally, perhaps by even inserting a hyphen between the prefix dis and the root that comes from the Latin tractus, from trahere, to pull, a hyphen then, or trait d'union, as we say in French, that remarks in the signifier, distrait, that remarks what this signifier states. Being distracted means being carried away by a pull, by a trait, by attraction that pulls or attracts you elsewhere. That is what being distracted literally means. Now, Benjamin finds the model for this distracted vision in the perception of architecture that, he says, introduces an anoptic, a non-optic element into optics, in other words, a tactile one. Quote, architectural buildings are received in a twofold manner, by touch and by sight. One cannot judge the reception of architecture in terms of the concentrated attention of a traveler before a famous building. In the tactile perception, there is no counterpart to what contemplation is in the optical perception. End of quote. What should, however, hold our attention here is not so much tactility as such, though, as you may remember, tactility also came to replace sight or to intrude within sight in the several passages we read on innervation, both in the Manifesto on a Proletarian Theatre for Children and in the notes towards a theory of gambling. But what interests me here is rather, on the one hand, that the gaze, given that it has incorporated the iconomic commodification of visual exchange in the form of exhibition value, given that it has innervated it, the gaze is constantly turning away, distracting itself from its object. So far from emerging into it through contemplation, the gaze is already expecting other visions. It is already preparing in advance to see more and more, to change views. It is taken away into what I would like to call a surplus sight, plus de vue, a surplus sight that prohibits it from ever settling down or fixating in contemplation. But what must also, on the other hand, give us pause is especially that this view determined by and for exchange, this view of exchange, in the double sense maybe of both a subjective and objective genitive, you know, the view of exchange, in short, this gaze woven from exchanges or having become exchange, is a gaze that forms what Benjamin calls a habit. In other words, it is a gaze disposed to dependency or addiction, Gewöhnung, writes Benjamin in the German versions. I quote, tactile reception comes about not so much by way of attention as by way of habit. Even the distracted person can form habits. What is more, it is only when we master certain tasks in a state of distraction that we are sure to solve them by habit. So, distraction and habit. Let's recapitulate and capitalize then on what our rereading of Benjamin's essay has brought to light. In film, or through film, perception is metamorphosed. The aesthesis is reorganized by getting innervated, and the gaze changes. As we can read a few lines later, I quote, "Reception in distraction, which is a symptom of profound changes in perception, finds in film its true field of experience," end of quote. Now, the exchange gaze that thus sees the light of day immediately and by the same token becomes a gaze that slips into the addictive dependency of distraction. Right? The exchange gaze immediately becomes a distracted gaze that contracts a habit. It becomes, in other words, a gaze on credit, an indebted gaze. The swapping form of the gaze thus makes possible the visual market where the fiction of exchange produces debt. There is no exchange image, I was saying when concluding my second lecture. There are only debt images. But a debt image, we must now add, is possible only in and through an exchange gaze. We still need to understand how and through what technologies of sight the cinematic equipment has thus transformed our visual organology by weaving into it a swapping contexture that has become constitutive of visibility. In short, we need to write the technical archaeology of this gaze, the material history of its innervation. This history, whose development would demand more time than I have left as I approach the end of this last lecture, this history passes in particular through the invention, the deployment, and planetary implantation of elevators, escalators, and moving sidewalks, which are as many machines that shift and shunt the consumer viewer. Machines to which we will also have to add all the apparatuses that, like revolving doors, for example, channel and measure the flows of buyers or flâneurs. Here, I will not be able to go through, maybe in the book, that will come out hopefully of these lectures, but not here. I will not be able to go through the long and fascinating genealogy that leads from the flying chairs of the 17th century to the mechanical stairs and sidewalks that crisscross and map out our movements in today's shopping malls. I will also not be able to show you in detail how these mobilizations of the gaze make their way into the world of film, not only by being staged and narrated in films, but also by being integrated into the very movements of the camera, by being literally confused with the twitches of the cine eye, of what Ziga Vertov, the famous Russian filmmaker, called the cine eye, the eye of the camera. Elevatoriality and escalatoriality, if I may name them this way, constantly oscillate between the diegetic space of the filmic narration that displays them, that represents them, and the metadiegetic level of the rhetoric of the camera movements that allow for their representation. So elevators and escalators, you find them in the films, of course, but they are also the very movements of the camera that allow for representing elevators and escalators, as I will show you in a moment. Now, within this vast archaeology of ocular cinemobility currently under construction, I will select a few remarkable moments and milestones. They should be put into the context of a long narrative that would make us journey, for example, from the first on-screen appearance of an escalator in Chaplin's The Floor Walker, 1916, to the memorable traveling shot on the moving sidewalk at the beginning of Tarantino's Jackie Brown, 1997, by way of the mechanical stairways bearing zombies in the shopping mall of Romero's Dawn of the Living Dead, 1978. And I can only note in passing that even the chronology of this narrative as a journey through time, this chronology would not be exterior to the story being told. It would not overlook the story from some extrinsic historical reason, since temporal movement is also dependent on these mobilizations of the gaze, both in its possibility and in its chronometric measurement. Now, let me just show you maybe the very beginning of Jackie Brown with the very nice traveling on a moving sidewalk. I was the first but your fight, doing whatever I had to do to survive. I'm not saying what I did was all right, trying to break out of the ghetto for the day to day fight, etc. It lasts for a very long time. I would just like to show it to you again, because I think that in this precise moment at the very beginning of this shot, we see both levels. You see the character travel on what was called a travelator at some point in history, so the moving sidewalk. And then 2 seconds later, you see the camera adopting the very same movement. So you have both the diegetic and metadiegetic level that are sort of put in gear, you know. So let me just show that again. Okay. We'll have the opportunity to see other moments from Jackie Brown for the Tarantino fans. If there is one filmic sequence emblematic of the way the mechanization of sight is coextensive with its inscription within a swapping supermarket, in all the senses of the term supermarket that we mentioned at the beginning of the first lecture, if you remember. So if there is one such sequence, really emblematic, it is certainly the credits, the opening credits of the Marx Brothers' 1941 The Big Store, in which, as you will see, the vertical scrolling of the images, so the very movement of the cinematographic projection that consists in the succession of stills on the unreeling film, this vertical scrolling overlaps and mixes exactly with the elevator's trajectory. Sorry, let me show you that. Etc. When the point of view, as you saw, when the point of view of the spectator of these credits rises from image to image, as if climbing from floor to floor in the stock of commodities displayed on sale, the cinematography of the gaze adopts the same elevating mechanism as the buyer ascending the degrees of this sanctuary of consumption. Moving through the history of film as a supermarket of mobilized gazes, we might stop our time machine, which might in fact take on the form of a chronological elevator. We might stop it on more recent scenes. I'm thinking of one of the most remarkable moments in the filmography of The Escalator, the finale of Carlito's Way, directed by Brian De Palma in 1993. There, we see the protagonist, Carlito Brigante, Al Pacino, who is attempting to get away from the Italian mafiosi chasing after him. And it is a mechanical staircase in Grand Central, in New York, that becomes the theater of a memorable series of circumvolutions over the course of a long and virtuoso sequence shot with the Steadicam. Twice, Carlito gets ready to take the escalator, but he stops and abruptly turns around at the last minute when he sees one of his pursuers at the bottom of the escalator. The first time, the camera following Carlito also backs up and accompanies him while he goes to hide behind a walled angle. The second time, however, the camera lets him turn around alone and takes the escalator, going down, as if its movement, untied from Carlito's and having become autonomous, as if its movement merged with that of the moving stairway. Let me show you that. So, as you saw, the camera thus arrives at the lower level where the mafiosi are. It rotates slowly and then goes back up with one of the mafiosis in the opposite direction, thus once again moving toward the upper floor where Carlito is, barely interrupted by the two inserts of the fat man running. The ascension of the camera, little by little, brings us closer to the mafioso's gaze, and we are on the verge of seeing a close-up of his eyes when suddenly the shot swerves to the right and shows the adjacent escalator going down. There, we see Carlito lying down on the steps, almost invisible, leaving the scene unnoticed. De Palma, then, brings this long sequence shot to a close by quickly alternating between the most contrasting shots. The camera adopts the point of view of Carlito, lying down, and observes the mafioso going up without seeing him. Then the camera stabilizes at mid-floor level for a medium-long shot of the passengers of the two escalators, and finally it rises vertically to show Carlito's descent from above, higher and higher above, as if our point of view were being carried away by an elevator. Let me show you that again. Interesting word here. As if we were in an elevator. So what is going on in this masterfully composed sequence just before the shooting then begins? Carlito seems to hesitate to go into the loop of the infinite revolution of the escalators, going up, down, up, down. But the camera, for its part, detaches itself from his character and willfully lets itself be taken up and meshed into the uninterrupted flow of the escalatorial machine. The movement that catches our eyes seems to be structurally destined to be put in gear with these conveyors, with these transmission belts that take the passengers away. And yet, the character of Carlito and the camera filming him attempt to remove themselves from the circulatory loop of endless exchange or circulation. It is as if Carlito were trying to make his way out through the bottom, while the camera, on the other hand, rises and keeps rising more and more to attempt to escape from the top. Right. Escape from the bottom or escape from the top. Symmetrical to the posture of the protagonist, glued to the steps as if to disappear into them, the ascension of the camera seeks to form a powerful vertical axis that could be contrasted with the infinite revolution of the escalators. Now, is this possible? Can one escape from this general mobilization and mechanization of the gaze, whose extent, a mechanization whose extent we can imagine by remembering, by recalling that the apparatus of all the elevators, escalators, and moving sidewalks in the world moves the equivalent of the population of the Earth every 3 days? I don't know if you knew that, but when I discovered that, I was, amazed. Another remarkable sequence, orchestrated by Brian De Palma in Body Double, 1984, stages a channeling of sight along slides that would be the equivalent for so-called natural perception of the cranes and dollies that organize the cine eye or the cine gaze. Up above, down below, all across, the mechanization of the movements along the rails, striating space in all directions, brings about as many shunts in the vision inside the Los Angeles shopping mall where the protagonist, Jake Scully, is following the mysterious Gloria Revelle after having watched her the night before with a telescope from the apartment he's living in. Let me show you that. As you saw, Jake falls into step behind Gloria and steps onto an escalator behind her. The camera also synchronizes with the movement of the mechanical stairway, merging with it, just as it will do 10 years later in Carlito's Way. Once they arrive upstairs, Gloria and Jake head toward a second escalator, but this time the camera films them from up above, higher and higher above, taking a long zoom out that makes it go from a middle shot to a general shot. Little by little, we see the entire mall, and we also see a panoramic elevator going up. Now, the camera's optical movement backwards and upwards is accomplished along a remarkable axis. I will show you the short sequence again. On the one hand, our gaze seems to be carried on vertical tracks, as if it had boarded an elevator. That would be the double of the one we just saw running up above. And on the other hand, our gaze retrogrades while remaining directed toward Jake and Gloria down below, so much so that the zoom back traces an oblique line, diagonal, that appears symmetrical to the escalator's line that we are observing. Let's watch that again. Look at the movement of the camera now. So it seems symmetrical to the escalator, and at the same time it seems to follow the course of an elevator. And it is of course punctuated by the sound of the doorbell of the elevator. Now, why insist, you might wonder, why insist, as I am doing here, on this virtuoso but apparently insignificant play with the camera movement imagined by De Palma? It's because the director's camera itself becomes a kind of body double, a double of both the elevator and the escalator, an undecidable double, then, that doubles the one, the elevator, and the other, the escalator, but also the one as the other, without affording us, and that's the important thing, without affording us any exterior point of view that would allow us to see the system of the gaze's transports from outside. We see these shifts and optical exchanges by being ourselves taken within them. We observe the escalator or the elevator from an elevator or an escalator, or from the general hoist, I could say, that pertains to both the one and the other, without being able to go beyond them, without being able to sublate them into an overlooking third term. In short, there is probably no dialectic in the habitual sense of the term in this economy of gazes for which the mall, filmed by De Palma, becomes the theater. There are eyes that slide along tracks that seem to distance and separate themselves from one another in order to be doubled and redoubled, in order to be exchanged within a general and permanent revolution from which none of them escapes. Which also means that we cannot simply leave the cinema or the shopping mall by substituting them with a non-equipped gaze or with virgin spaces, because the commodified networking of vision is more than ever carried on outside the film and outside the mall with the unprecedented development of eye-tracking technologies and video-elevating apparatuses of all kinds. Far beyond film and shopping malls, there are, in effect, elevators Well, on the scroll bars of the screens that accompany us in each of our daily gestures, and the commercial applications of eye tracking are proliferating both on the internet and elsewhere. An example among many others. On May 27, 2013, last year, a promotional article in the Swiss edition of the free daily 20 Minutes heralded an advertising event that had taken place a few days earlier. I quote from the newspaper, "At the main Zurich train station, passers-by had the opportunity to win a Samsung Galaxy S4 simply by using their eyes. The person who did not move their eyes from the new smartphone for an hour left with one. But the exercise was not as simple as it sounds. One simple glance to the side, even a furtive one, and all was lost." Let me show you a small clip made by Samsung. It is very interesting. Now, the smartphone in question detects, as you understood, the ocular movements of the user and, for example, allows him or her to control with one's eyes the elevatorial function named smart scroll. In other words, the gaze itself here immediately becomes an elevator or a hoist, even, why not, an escalator or a travelator, thanks to this technology whose name, eye tracking, is abyssal if one pays attention, since one can understand it both as the eye being tracked, the eye whose trace is being followed, and the eye that is equipped with rails or tracks. This promotional campaign is a sign or symptom of the advanced stage and extent of the development of the gaze's innervation discussed by Benjamin. One also gets a good idea of this from the remarkable film by German director Harun Farocki called Die Schöpfer der Einkaufswelten, The Creators of the Shopping Worlds, 2001, a film in which the director interviewed the engineers, architects, and marketing specialists who plan the spaces of a shopping mall. When one watches the calibration of the eye of a potential client in order to then be able to calculate the ocular points of impact within the plethora of brands, signs, and commercial stimulations of all kinds that cover the walls of the galleries in this consumerist cave, the scene recalls another moment in a totally different genre, recalls the moment in Jackie Brown when the eponymous character stops for an instant at the entryway to Delamo Mall in the little town of Torrance, close to Los Angeles in California. And previously, we could read on the screen, it's the largest indoor mall in the world. Well, then we see the system, again, of mechanical mobilizations of the gaze formed by the elevator and escalator channeling the flow of buyers. And immediately afterwards, thanks to a counter shot that allows us to see the protagonist's eyes, we observe their twitches that seem to repeat the same mechanized movements. Let me show you first the sequence from the Farocchi film, Die Schöpfer der Einkaufswelten. So this is an eye-tracking sequence.
In this case, indicating different scenes of a mall. They walk themselves from one scene to the next at their own pace, spending as much or as little time with each scene.
Okay. And let me show you now a moment from Jackie Brown. So, the promotional campaign for the smartphone that reacts to the slightest wink also signals something else. In the challenge launched as an apparently innocent game, this campaign signified not only that the space within which our gaze moves is clearly marked and mapped out in all its trajectories, it also stated that the gaze produces value because it works, because it is work time, an hour of captive attention. In other words, the commercial stakes of today's media for images, of which the so-called smartphone is only one example among others, the commercial stakes is not only that the gaze becomes, I quote Deleuze, the general equivalent of movement, as Deleuze said, speaking of the camera, of the cinematographic apparatus that our eyes will have ended up innervating. It is also, and above all, what Deleuze described as, I quote, the dissymmetrical exchange, unequal and without equivalent, in other words, giving images against money, of course, but also, and on top of that, giving time against images. General innervation through elevatoriality, that graft that ends up forming the very texture of a gaze set on the tracks for swapping within the aesthetic supermarket, that graft or innervation is therefore the equipment that makes the valorization of economic capital possible. The gaze at work creates surplus value, surplus view, we might say, to the precise extent that it constitutes supplementary work without exchange nor equivalent. The indebtedness of the distracted, or I could even say maybe distract gaze, the indebtedness of this gaze, its economic addiction, in other words, what we have called the debt image, is thus constituted against the backdrop of the privatization of vision. It is the result of a capture and an appropriation of the perceptive field, of a nomos of the sensible, we could say with Carl Schmitt. But this hold or this stranglehold, even if it certainly bears the mark of identified brands. Let me name haphazardly some of them: Samsung, Google, Netflix, Apple, HBO, etc. The list would be long. Even if it bears the marks of these brands, this seizure then cannot, in the end, be attributed to any one of these authorities in particular. It is much rather on its way to becoming the very innervation of our capacity to see. From his Marxian and revolutionary perspective, Benjamin, as you will remember, spoke of, I quote, a momentary enslavement to the powers of the apparatus that might in time leave room for release by this same apparatus. End of quote. Now the question addressed to us, and that I will leave you with, the question addressed to us from these lines, written in 1936, this question should no doubt be formulated this way: this release, how might we see it coming? Thank you very much.